This is the Faith Debate, a theological roundtable gab fest with the Mixmaster as the master of ceremonies and the notorious Triple B, the big bridge builder. Can we build it? Yes, we can. The Faith Debate is a free-for-all forum.
Hoo-ah!
Where faith community leaders wrestle over the truth.
Yabba-dabba-doo.
In less than 30 minutes, learn more about what really matters than others learn in a month.
Ooh, how convenient.
Are you ready for a clash of ideas? Are you ready for the sound of freedom?
Let's get ready to rumble!
Let's get ready to rumble.
Ah, yeah!
In this corner, weighing in with a Master of Divinity from Reformed Theological Seminary, the Faith Debate Master of Ceremonies, Troy Skinner.
You got a moron.
And in this corner, weighing in as a pastor, teacher, and founder of Bridges, connecting needs and resources in the local community,
ooh, mama,
the notorious Big Bridge Builder, John Switzer.
Now I'm just getting warmed up.
How have disparate cultures understood the scriptures historically? For example, Jewish versus Christian, Alexandria versus Antioch in the Patriarchs, Rome versus Constantinople, Rome versus the Protestants. Today, we're probably going to need to establish early on in the show the basis for accepting that different groups might find themselves inclined to interpret the scriptures in different ways. Who knew? Go figure. Here to do that, Jonathan Switzer, serving the Frederick area community now for more than 18 years, currently as founder of Bridges, and Michelle Rader, lead elder at Damascus Road Community Church. So, I wouldn't have realized it until I brought up the topic just now, and it occurs to me, but people do tend to approach the Bible a little differently. It's not a monolith.
It took us like 12 years having this show to realize that's the case.
I just figured that out. That's why we keep having fodder for discussion, right? That's why this show continues to exist.
Yes.
Because not everybody looks at every passage of Scripture the exact same way. Well, first of all, not everybody even looks at Scripture the same way. You know, what is Scripture? What are the Scriptures?
Right.
Those sorts of things. But even when we agree that, you know, the gospel according to Mark, that is Scripture.
Yeah.
You know, we interpret it differently depending on what school of thought we're coming from, what perspective we come from. What our predispositions are as we enter into the text. So some of them I think are more valid than others. Maybe we'll explore some of those differences as we go.
Just for fun, yeah.
So, and I think what prodded this this panel to come together, is I think Michelle was reading a book, right? And you mentioned the book to John, and John said, ooh, that sounds really interesting.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some of the things that book talks about on the show. Is that right?
Yes, actually, it's Scripture and Its Interpretation, which is edited by Michael Gorman, who is a professor at St. Mary's Seminary and University in Baltimore. And I'm actually doing a master's there right now, and I'm his research assistant. So I read this book for a class, as well as helped with the newest edition that he published last year. And our elder board is reading it and discussing it, just because it offers a lot of good insight on the history of interpretation.
And is it a book for a classroom? I mean, is it an academic book?
It's aimed at a classroom setting, but it has discussion questions in each chapter, so it could certainly be used by, you know, a church class or
And the title again?
Scripture and Its Interpretation.
Okay, so if you want to challenge yourself and read something that's not, you know, Max Lucado or a Nora Roberts novel or something, then you're
going to go to Amazon.
So how many books a year are the elders at your church required to read?
Well, it varies. We actually haven't read a book for several years, but we've read, we did N.T. Wright's Surprised by Hope a few years ago. It sort of just depends what topics are coming up.
Sure.
As a non-denominational church, we have a lot of people from a lot of different backgrounds. We thought this was probably time to sort of look at the history of interpretation and be more aware of the fact that people do come from, you know, very different assumptions.
You know, a couple of years ago, as we were doing this show, I realized that the group of churches that I've been a part of growing up has a distinctive approach to interpreting Scripture, and I realized that it wasn't always like clear to me what that was. And when I began to ask, I almost ran into like a sense that was like an uncomfortable question for people to ask. You know, when we're looking at passages, are we looking for a literal you know, translation? Are we looking to build, you know, some kind of allegorical, you know, larger story into passages? And the allegorical in particular, like, I just found myself uncomfortable with because it's a little bit harder to get real clear about what we're all supposed to agree that it means. You know, when you move into some of the allegory, it's a little bit more personal, you know, each individual, subjective is the word I'm looking for.
Let's start with very basic building blocks. So let's start with, you know, everybody on the panel today is a Christian.
Okay.
And so everybody on the panel is going to agree that the Bible is scripture. Right. So we're not going to debate that. That's a different show. We have somebody else on who wants to say, no, that's not scripture. But we're all in agreement, so we'll start with that. So let's talk about the Bible as scripture. What are some of the various ways that Christians might view the Bible? Or even non-Christians, I guess, but particularly how would Christians maybe approach the Bible? What are some of the basic ways?
Well, I kind of feel like the question begins with, how did the Jewish people view their Bible? And that's kind of really where I got drawn into.
All right. Well, how do the Jews view the Bible?
What Michelle's what this book was all about. Well, that was the point, is that after Plato and Aristotle, there was a sense with before Christ, you know, 100, 150 years, 200 years before Christ, that the Jewish people were trying to grapple with how do they, in a Greco-Roman worldview. It was actually Greek originally. How do they, interpret their scriptures, you know, in lieu of a Greek culture? You know, are there do the idioms, you know, do the ideas about who God is translate effectively? And so they started to grapple with whether or not they should be more allegorical themselves. Am I reading that right?
Yeah, I think there was certainly, you know, a lot of discussion in Jewish circles during that time of how to read the Bible and even what it is. That it's during that time that the Jewish canon is forming in terms of, you know, which books do we read. And that's, I think, one of the interesting things, too, from a Christian standpoint is, you know, how did all of these books get determined as to which ones are part of Scripture?
And you just used plural, so let me go with that. I mean, some people think of it as a collection of books, and there's a sense in which that's totally fair and true. And there are other people who will talk about the good book. It's one book. You know, the Bible is a book. And then there's debate over how many sections are in it, something more of a library. So I don't really think I know the answer to this. You guys might be more adept at answering this. The Jews, particularly the more ancient Jews, did they tend to look at their scriptures as one, quote-unquote, book, one canon, or do they have a tendency to look at it as a library of inspired?
Well, this is, I think, one of the things that's interesting is how technology impacts that sort of question. Because, you know, remember
because
the Jews
iPhone came out back then, and it changed everything for when they were creating the Septuagint back in Alexandria. Sorry.
No, well, because back in that in the Jewish time, they had scrolls. This was the codex, the book, being able to put something into a book with pages. That didn't come about till about 200 A.D. So before that, the individual books were in scrolls and they could be in a big pile, and it wasn't as important to figure out which one of these scrolls always belong and always go together. They didn't even think of it that way because they didn't come all attached. Once you started to be forming these scrolls into books, you had to start saying, okay, what belongs in this book that's not going to come apart or be in a pile anymore?
And so that's the part that as I was reading this particular book that I'm not sure that I'm fully confident that they really didn't have a sense that these ones belong and other ones don't. Like, they had their pile of scrolls, but like how – and there was a sense that certain groups had extra scrolls in their pile and certain other groups, you know, so like the Qumran community, you know, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, they had – a number of extra scrolls in their pile that wouldn't be in a Jewish canon today. But there's so can I just pierce into that a little bit, your understanding of it, and I'm trying to grapple with my own understanding, so I'm probably in over my depth, but there was still a sense that, you know, like the Torah is like a necessary scroll, right? And then the history books or testimonies is often what it was called, would be like an important scroll, and Chronicles coming later perhaps than Kings because, you know, it came out of it seemed to be finalized later, you know. And then of course the wisdom books and the prophetic books like Isaiah, Jeremiah. And so, but then it was these extra, we call them extra canonical now, meaning these extra books that, like, there was still a sense, am I right, that you had the basic scrolls that everybody kind of agreed on, and then there were some people would add some to that, and some people would take away some from that. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's fair. And you did have the Septuagint that was formed before Christ and before the time of Christ. And that was a pretty standardly accepted sort of grouping.
And for the uninitiated, Septuagint is the Hebrew Bible is translated into Greek, and there were the legend anyway is that there were 70 translators, scribes that were working on that, and so we get our word Septuagint from that, means the 70, I think, or something like that.
Wasn't the legend that they all translated it separately and they all came up with the exact same translation?
That is the legend.
That's the legend.
Yeah. So, yeah. There you have it.
So anyway, so that's just a fancy word that most people who haven't gone to seminary don't know what
now,
that is.
Now, am I right that the Targums, is that the right word, was being developed at the same time? So the Hebrew was being translated into Syrian or Aramaic?
Aramaic.
Yeah, at the time?
Yeah, it's around that time period, and the Targums being sort of a commentary, so scripture along with a commentary.
So it was a translation with a commentary attached to it, both of which arose not just because – well, it arose because Jews weren't speaking Hebrew anymore. They were either speaking Aramaic or they were speaking Greek, and so it just didn't help to have a Hebrew scriptures. There had to be a translation, which means that you got to start interpreting it at a whole different level, right? I mean, so the whole discussion about how to interpret the scriptures seems to arise precisely at the point at which we have to cross from one language to another, and that all the same words don't exactly translate from one language to another.
That's the voice of Jonathan Schweitzer rocking the pink today. Not wearing pink today is Michelle Rader. I'm not wearing pink either.
That's right.
I'm Troy Skinner. This is the Faith Debate on 930 WFMD. So continuing this track of comparison contrast with how we might think about things today with how the ancient Jews or ancient Israel would have thought about things. A lot of Christians today will talk about a meta-narrative, the Bible as one big giant story.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, would the Jews have thought in those terms as well? And a lot of times the Christian will think in terms of the story being this love letter from God, and it's an invitation to Christ sort of thing. Were the Jews looking at it in any way, shape, or form as an invitation into worship of the God of Israel? So I don't know. Do we know the answer to that?
Reading the Bible is that it must have. And yet there seems to be a sense that maybe those narratives weren't as clear as I think they are.
Well, I think the Jews certainly were very cognizant of themselves having a story with God, and that began, back with the Exodus and all the way back to Abraham. And so I think they very much thought in that term, and they saw that story going to the Messiah. That's what they were looking for. But once the Messiah came, he looked very different from what they were expecting. And
I think the story kind of got turned around
at that point.
I think that the difference is in the what we now call the Old Testament, it's all telling the story of the need for the Messiah to come, because the people are rebellious, they're stiff-necked. Every time God entrusts them to do something, they reject him left and right, and they bring up a king, and the king fails, and they have prophets that don't get the job done, and they're failing at every turn. They need a Messiah, and so everything's pointing to Jesus, and of course the New Testament is pointing to Jesus too, but it's a different kind of pointing, right? They're pointing ahead to something they're expecting, and the Christian is pointing to someone who already exists and inviting someone to accept the invitation.
Well,
right.
And the question of interpretation, I feel like, is exacerbated, made more painful by the fact that Jesus said to the Pharisees of the day that here I am right in front of you, but you don't see me, while others did see him. So there even seemed to be a sense that there were different groups of people that maybe were interpreting the scriptures more appropriately and others that were not. Like when Jesus says in John has Jesus saying that if you had believed Moses, you would believe me. but because you don't believe Moses, you don't believe me. And so it seems to give me the impression that couple hundred years before Christ, that there were groups that were moving away from a better way of interpreting, and others that were moving toward, you know, a more accurate or more, I mean, what's the term to use there? God wanted them to view their scriptures a certain way. Jesus expected them to view their scriptures a certain way. And if they did, then they would see Jesus when he stood in front of them. But if they didn't, then they would reject Jesus when he's standing in front of them.
Although, in all fairness, I think when you look at the disciples who are closest to Jesus, even when he's telling them very specifically, I'm going to be killed and raised on the third day, even when he's being very specific, they don't understand that. They don't connect it to the scriptures. And it's really only after Christ's death and resurrection, when he comes back on the road to Emmaus and opens the scriptures to them, that's really the first time that any of them really start to say, oh, wow, that is
right.
What
if the Spirit of God doesn't illuminate the scriptures, you just can't see it. That's kind of a lesson there.
Okay, well, that's interesting. Or is it that again, I'm assuming something, and I would admit that I'm kind of being very judgmental, and that I approach this in a very judgmental way in terms of how the Jewish people were interpreting their own scriptures, just because Jesus seems to be very judgmental towards them. And so even though I have no business, you know, aligning myself as like the Christ-like one, you know, that can take on the resentments of Jesus himself, nevertheless, he's the one that says, you know, how long must I put up with you, you know, and how foolish and how blind you are, meaning that he seems to still have an expectation that they should view the scriptures from a certain direction. And even, and so in those moments when they didn't, he's not saying, yeah, I get that. Here, let me, you guys just couldn't have known this before now. And so let me show you, you know, the right way to view scriptures. And instead, it's a rebuke that says, you know, how long must I put up with you? You know, it's right in front of your face. You just can't see it yet. And of course, that's still true about us today, you know, that we struggle. So I wouldn't argue that somehow I'm better than the disciples, but it does seem to be the case that there was, and so this is the side of me that I want to openly admit, I think is very conservative, you know, like I want an absolute right and wrong, but it appears to me that Jesus is pointing at a right way to read the scriptures that the worst of them couldn't even see who Jesus was. The best of them could see Jesus, but still didn't get exactly what he was all about. But that it still came back to, were they reading the scriptures the way that God wanted them to read the scriptures? And so I don't know if that's accurate or not, but I feel like I'm stuck in a certain place.
It's interesting. It strikes me that, I don't know that I really think about this very often, but you know, we started off today talking about how there's not this monolithic view and approach to the scriptures. And here we are kind of talking in monolithic terms for the ancient Jews. And we forget sometimes, precisely, right, that the what we call the Old Testament was written over hundreds of years. And so they must have had their own interpretive challenges like we do. Like there would have been idioms from 500 years earlier that were no longer contemporary.
Precisely,
to them. Yeah. And they're having to figure out and wrestle with, okay, what's the setting? Right. What's the geography? What's the history? What genre of literature am I reading? Like, they must have had some of the – they might not have put it the way we put it in today's
that's
critical
part that
categories.
Was new to me, because like Philo is described in the book as grappling with how could God have actually killed all the people that he tells Joshua to kill. Right. And so he's grappling with, you know, how do you think that's a good God, that's a, you know, enlightened God. And so he was grappling with those very issues, very, you know,
which a lot of people still grapple with today. And it is interesting to see that some of the questions that we bring to scripture today were questions that were wrestled with, you know, 2000 years ago by Jewish interpreters then.
Yeah, yeah.
And we know that there was, you know, like you said, not a monolithic interpretive school within Judaism, because there was the Sadducees and the Pharisees, for example,
yeah,
as well as, you know, a number of other
right.
groups. So just like, you know, we have our various interpretive schools today and different traditions, they certainly had theirs. You know, I think what has been unfortunate in Christian history is that Jesus rebukes two you know, certain members of the, you know, the scribes or Pharisees or Sadducees over time got extrapolated onto all the Jewish people in terms of how Christians treated Jews throughout too much of history. And so, you know, they sort of applied that to, okay, all Jews are just cursed by God. And that's had a very unfortunate
impact. I think that's a very important point. It appears to me that since the Holocaust, that the Christian world has been at pains to kind of purge anti-Semitism from our theologies. In I think I sense a check in my spirit, you know, it's a good Pentecostal way to say it, you know, like there's a red flag that goes up for me that that if our goal is to purge anti-Semitism, like that in and of itself is an interpretive choice that feels to me too arbitrary, that the goal of purging something out, you know, then we got to get into definitions of anti-Semitism and those kinds of things. But some of my Messianic Jewish friends are some of the most honest, I feel like, and they're free maybe to be honest because, you know, they're of a blood heritage, you know, of Judaism, but they're the most willing to speak negatively about the Jews of the day. I find, you know, across the whole church that others, you know, are often less willing to do so. And that's an interpretive technique that.
Well, I think you're always, you know, we always feel like it's okay for us to criticize our own family, but when someone outside the family criticizes them, then, you know, we're going to be defensive.
Yeah,
but I think you're absolutely right. Since the Holocaust, you know, there has been a lot of, and I think rightly so, Christian soul searching about, you know, how Jews were treated for many centuries, you know, because Germany was a Christian nation. I mean, the Holocaust came out of the nation of Martin Luther that gave birth to Protestantism. So I think, you know, there was rightfully some soul searching of saying, well, how could a Christian nation with all that Christian history have done this?
Yeah, well, there's the debate, Christian in name only, perhaps.
Yes.
You know, Christian by history and heritage, but maybe not in practice and in actual faith.
And in fact, right? that feeds into this question. Were there interpretive choices that the German church was making in the late 1800s, early 1900s, that led them to a place of accepting what we look back and see as just pure evil? And I feel like that there were some specific choices that were made that that I find myself, you know, at pains to try to avoid, you know, at this time.
Yeah, so we'll pick up next week. We'll continue this conversation. We'll talk a little bit more about some interpretive principles. We'll talk about we touched on canon, but I want to spend a little more time on that, because there's some interpretation maybe that's involved in how deciding what's canon, what's not. And then we'll get into some more practical applications for somebody that's wanting to read their Bible and think about how to understand it, and walk through some of the possible approaches that people could do. So we'll start down that path next week. John Schweitzer, thank you. Michelle Rader, thank you. I'm Troy Skinner. Thank you for listening to The Faith Debate. We're online at WFMD.com, keyword faith. Until next week, 167 and a half hours from now, God bless.